Hello and welcome everyone to the first gathering of this wonderful exploration that we're making together to bring more calm and confidence and joy to your parenting and to your life. This is How to Parent for Peace, 5 tools to transform stressed out into sane and centered. I'm so pleased to have you with me for this program. I'm Dr. Marcy Axness, early development specialist, parent coach, and author of Parenting for Peace, Raising the Next Generation of Peacemakers. And we're here to do just that, raise peacemakers to share with the world. And in the meantime, to enjoy our children more and spread more tranquility and delight all around, yes? So today is Module 1, which is Presence. So just by way of a quick orientation about our time together, we're going to spend somewhere between 75 and 90 minutes together, probably closer to 90, knowing myself. I always try to squeeze in every nugget I can. So I'm going to start with an explanation of the tool, of the presence tool, and a couple of quick examples of an application of it. Then I'm going to cover a little bit of the neuroscience and the research, because I really find that understanding the whys of the tool brings extra confidence and extra commitment to really digging in and using it when you really understand what's driving it and what it creates. Then we're going to really spend a good deal of our time today covering concrete ways to strengthen your capacity for presence. A lot of practical applications and examples there. And also a little bit about where it fits in relation to status quo parenting. And then I like to wrap up with a go-to fail-safe move using the tool, and then a little bit of homework. And hopefully we'll have some time for questions. But again, unless there's something really pressing that is an obstacle to you, I really find it works well to sit with the material, over the next few days and sort of let it marinate and see what arises for you. And our coaching calls are really to cover questions. Now, I do have a disclaimer. And that is that I do cover a lot of material in my courses. So what this invites you to do is really attune yourself and listen for what resonates for you. This is like a banquet. And you'll have recordings of each module, so you'll be able to circle back and pick up layers that you didn't get the first time around. This is deep stuff, and it invites you to excavate, to really sink into the material gradually and organically while you do start engaging in the new behaviors that themselves help create positive change. So I like to start with just a very brief centering, grounding moment. So I'd like you to just take a couple of nice, comfortably deep breaths. Unless you're driving, I'd like you to close your eyes if that's comfortable. And just feel that breath moving in, through, and out. And just feel yourself sinking in to this moment, into wherever you are at this moment, your chair, the floor where you're standing. Feeling the connection of your body to that surface. As you breathe in, just feel yourself sink a little more there. Feel the rootedness there and the comfort of that. You are held. And these moments together are for you. And you can let everything else drop away. And take one more nice cleansing breath and let it out. And come back to the moment ready to take in some of this banquet. I also like to start each module with a quote. one of my favorite quotes. And this one is from John O'Donohue, who is just one of the most beautiful writers, Irish Catholic poet, scholar, mystic. He passed away a couple of years ago, way too young. And here is what he says about presence. When all the saying is said and all the doing is done, everything comes down to the integrity of individual presence. So, presence, what is it? I define it as being fully engaged right here, right now, with your body, your thoughts, and your feelings. On your e-guide, which I've explained to you in emails, but I'll say it again, the e-guide is for you alone. It is not an assignment or anything that anyone else is going to look at or judge. It's for you to help you deepen your grasp of and your engagement with these tools. And it also gives us some meaty stuff to bring to the coaching calls. To me, the ideal would be for you to punch holes in them. It's very old-fashioned, I know, and put pages, put the pages into a notebook and just keep adding your thoughts in there as they come to you, because this is an ever-deepening process, and maybe even put some blank pages in between so that you have more space to write. So anyway, on your e-guide, I've asked you to think of some things that you do, any activities you do where you get into what Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, yes, that is the name. He wrote a book, that famous book called Flow. What is it that you do where you find yourself in that flow, where time falls away and you just are in that place of being totally present? So it's easy to define presence, but is it easy to do? I find that it's actually not easy for most people. And if it's easy for you, then you've got a leg up. So what typically tends to happen is, you know, even when we're making a concerted effort to, you know, be here now, you know, 30 seconds later, you're thinking about how you need to get the leak in the bathroom faucet looked at, or, oh gosh, I've got to get, you know, Johnny onto the list for that new school. And, you know, it's a very human struggle. And it turns out that the capacity for presence turns out to be mediated by a particular structure in our brain's right hemisphere. And so some of what we're going to be talking today is the fact that whatever our capacity for presence is, we are downloading that continuously to our children. In a moment, we're going to get into that little bit of science block so we can really have a good working understanding of presence as a human capacity. And presence is unique among these five Parenting for Peace tools in that it is a human capacity that we are then in turn using as a tool. The others are actually just tools, things you do. Presence is less about things to do and more about ways to be. And that's why I cover it first. And I ask you to just trust that this will take root. I could have started with one of the tools that's a little bit more straightforward, things to do, like zip your lip. But instead, I'm kind of pushing you into the deep end, because this way you have 10 weeks to spend cultivating your presence capacity so that the tool becomes more and more available and powerful for you to use. And the better you get with presence, the more adept you'll become with the other four tools. So before we dive into the science a bit, and don't get scared off, I try to make it fun, I want to come out of the gate here with a couple of world-class examples of presence in action, presence as one of the five Parenting for Peace tools. The first one, and I've given you space on your e-guide to fill in some ideas. You don't have to do it now, but as I'm talking, they might come to you or later. The first one is called My World, Your World, Our World, and it is not my own. I got this from Kim John Payne, he's the author of Simplicity Parenting, but this didn't appear there. This was in one of his talks many, many years ago that he gave at the Waldorf School in my town. This is wonderful for those countdown moments. We all have them, you know, every day when we have young kids. It's when you want your child to be ready to do something, you know, in 10 minutes or whatever. Classic example is dinner, so that's what we're going to use here. And he or she is deeply engrossed in something else. So I'm going to give you the example of little Aram is playing with his Brio train. I don't even know if that's terribly old-fashioned. If people still play with Brio trains, I hope they do. Could be Legos, whatever it is. And the countdown begins. So Mom calls from the kitchen, Aram, dinner's going to be ready in 10 minutes, honey. Almost time to wash your hands. Okay, and then 5 minutes later, this repeats, Aram, 5 minutes, put away your stuff and go wash your hands. And then in 5 minutes, of course you know what's coming. There's no clean hands. There's no Aram. And, of course, where does Mom find him? Still surrounded by his train parts or his Legos or whatever it is. So here's the presence tool in action in that same scenario. Instead of calling from the kitchen, Mom goes to Aram, who, by the way, isn't just playing with his train. He is immersed in another whole reality. And this is a really good thing that he can do that. We never want to punish that. That in itself is presence in action. So then Mom just sits next to Aram for a few moments, just being present. And then Aram turns his attention to her. He cannot help but do that. He's wired for it. Okay, we're working with our neurobiology here. And that's when she says, dinner's going to be ready in a few minutes. I'd better go back and grate the cheese just like you like it. And then they each return to their worlds. She goes back to the kitchen. He goes back to his trains. Then she comes back another time or maybe two times this way, so that there is an intersection of her world and his world. They aren't colliding like they so often do, but they instead become our world. And things happen with so much more ease and harmony in our world. So there are, of course, as many variations on this as there are parents and children and imaginations. And I seem to remember when Ian was engrossed in his trains, that's why I use this example, I guess, he liked Brio trains, you know, I might show up and say, excuse me, the train's engineer has requested that you come have dinner in the dining car of another train. You know, it's over here, pointing towards the dining room table. The point is here, the more we can be playful and lighthearted and calm. You know, and of course, this is a big objective of what we're talking about through these whole 10 weeks. But so that is My World, Your World, Our World. Here's the other one. I call it the I hear you, I see you use of presence. If you go to any park on any day in any city, you will see a child fall down and start to cry, and then you will see his mother come in and swoop him up and begin to chant kind of incessantly, oh, you're okay, patting him on the back. You're okay, you're okay. No blood, there's no blood, you're okay. I mean, we're all familiar with this scene, and we've probably done it. But meanwhile, the child is wailing. Only very occasionally will you see a mother who calmly just reflects her child's true experience. Yes, love, I saw that you tripped over that bucket and fell down. That hurt, didn't it? Or maybe, you know, maybe there was no actual hurt. But, I bet that was scary, huh, falling off the swing like that. So this mother is reflecting what is so, not what she wishes were so. And her cry, you know, her child's crying ebbs away, and he's ready to get back to his business of playing because he's been heard. This presence is a form of nurturance that fosters connection between a parent and a child, but also between a child and his or her inner knowing, which is so important. And that's another sort of tangent discussion that maybe we can get into in another week, is this importance of keeping a child connected to their own inner truth. In so many ways, we tend to erode that. Telling them they are things when they're not, or they're not things when they are. So, as I promised or threatened, let's get into a little bit of the science behind this tool. And also, you know, this is central to talking about what presence has to do with attachment. So presence, attachment, and optimal development are all intimately linked. A parent's ability to be present for their child is a prerequisite for healthy attachment, period. This is what all of the latest attachment research shows. Presence is everything. That ability to be right here, right now, all of you. So for a child to develop secure attachment, they first and foremost need regular doses of the undistracted, full presence of a primary attachment figure. Now, I'm going to be talking later about what I mean by that and what I don't mean. It doesn't mean 24/7 carrying your child around on your hip at all. Regular doses of your full presence. Gaber Mate, who wrote a wonderful book called Scattered, which is ostensibly about preventing ADD, but it really is a primer on the neurobiology of attachment. He once told me, he said this, it's not in, written down anywhere, he didn't write it in a book, he told me this on a phone call, but it's so wonderful. He said, if anyone had ever asked me to throw myself into a fire for my child, I'd have done it. Unfortunately, no one ever asked me to throw myself into a fire. My child just needed me to be present. And I think this captures the experience of so many of us where, you know, we would walk through fire for our kids. We would do anything. And yet the very simple yet not easy gift of presence is really what they need. Just as an infant uses the nourishment of, you know, that mother's milk to build her bones and organs, she uses the attachment relationship to learn about the world and to prepare herself to excel in that world, hopefully connected to herself, to others, capable of empathy, vision, enlightened action, all of these capacities that we are envisioning for the peacemaker. And these are all brain-based capacities. These all require a healthy social brain. And it's on your e-guide, a little chart list of the capacities of this centrally important structure of our right hemisphere that scientists have zeroed in on as sort of the command central of social intelligence, called the orbitofrontal cortex. It sits right behind your right eye. And this is a structure that integrates and regulates. And integration and self-regulation are really fundamental to our mental health. So I've listed the different sort of functions that the OFC governs. It's all about having that EQ, being able to integrate your feelings with your thoughts, you know, to integrate intellectual with emotional, to have people skills, to be able to read people's intentions, the skills of truly being human, really, to be able to attune with someone else, to have empathy, and to have that sort of reciprocal communication that involves. It also governs our autonomic nervous system state regulation. The autonomic nervous system is the part of our being that, you know, it's like our gas and our brakes. And there, it's made up of two branches, the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. The parasympathetic is the part that calms us down when we get overly stimulated, and the sympathetic is what sort of amps us up, what, you know, gets us standing up in the morning. So both of these functions terminate in the OFC. So the OFC acts as a kind of a clutch to balance out these functions. So if you look at all those first four on the list, you can see why the OFC has been really implicated in a lot of the disorders that are disorders of self-regulation and integration, all these sensory processing disorders, attention deficit, all of these. And so if we can foster really robustly healthy OFC development, that acts as like an inoculation against this epidemic of disorders. And the last one is it gives us what they call autobiographical memory. It allows us to do this mental time travel that's involved in telling our own story. When I was 3, blah, blah, blah. When I was 17, this, that, and the next. So I call the OFC the Human Being Success Center because it really is the brain circuitry that is responsible for social and emotional functioning that is central to a person's lifelong success. So the technology to wire the OFC up most effectively is not some expensive gadget. It is definitely not baby Einstein. It is not lapware, appware, iPad screen. It has nothing to do with any screens. But it does involve a very complicated technology, and I included a picture on your guide of this technology. You know, so often simple doesn't always mean easy. And it also doesn't mean that it isn't complicated. The technology going on inside of our skulls is staggering. It is breathtaking. So, you know, the way that your child's OFC, this command central for all aspects of life, gets most optimally wired is illustrated in that beautiful Mary Cassatt painting. Nature's perfect plan for wiring up brain development requires nothing more than your presence. And nature has this elegant plan. A newborn's brain circuitry is wired and primed at birth for interacting with and interpreting one thing, the human face. To be gazing at your face is one of the very first ways that a newborn starts regulating her states. So let's talk a little bit about regulation, which is, like I said, it's one of the two basic foundations of sound mental and emotional health. And you see in the little diagram, I saw that jagged up and down, like looks like a mountain range. Babies start like that in terms of their state regulation. And by states, I mean states are early precursors of our feelings, of our emotions, and they are rooted in biology. They are physical feelings. So it's feeling hungry. It's feeling scared. Actually, attachment is completely rooted in biology. And so to be unattached, to be separate, that gets registered as absolutely physiological sensations. And so we all, I'm sure we've all been with newborns. If you're on this call, you've probably been with a newborn or two. And we know how quickly they can go from everything's fine to there's a big storm. And it's because their little tiny, tiny walnut-sized stomach can suddenly feel empty, painfully empty so quickly. Anyway, over time, that mountain range softens out. It smooths out into those rolling hills. And it does that through the parent's regulation. And how that happens is baby starts getting distressed. We all know it intuitively, but the science behind it has only been revealed in the last 15, 20 years, and it's fascinating. When we pick up a baby, and you know, we invariably gaze at the baby as well, the distress starts to ebb, okay? And it isn't just the touch. What's happening is there is a mind meld going on. This is the basics of interpersonal neurobiology, which is a new field in the last 20 years. when we hold a baby and, you know, and do those sort of those dances and where you coo and I coo and you laugh and I laugh, these are mutually attuned, collaborative and reciprocal interactions where we're tuning into one another within split, you know, nanoseconds. They've done, you know, all sorts of video. It's, you know, what's happening is the baby is piggybacking on the regulating abilities of the adult to manage his own affective states. And it's truly like mind melding. We become one biological unit. One of the scientific papers refers to it as open loop neurophysiology. We become a single loop together, and that baby is riding on your OFC's self-regulation ability and, you know, sort of piggybacking on it. And the thing is, we all require close connection with others. It is the process that is used by social mammals to tune each other's neurophysiological steadiness. So here you have this scene. Baby's hungry. Mama responds. And by the way, I'm going to say mama, mother. I absolutely include that could be a father, it could be a grandmother. Certainly in the very early days, you know, nature intended that it be mother because there's all sorts of physiological ties that are that exist there that the baby is looking for. That's a whole other hour. So mama responds, and the baby feels better. And the implicit learning happening there, implicit learning being a whole raft of learning that happens outside of conscious awareness. You know, the baby is not even verbal yet. What's happening is there is an association of distress and then the relief that comes with mom. And what happens is imprints happen. The baby imprints these patterns of response, and then these patterns accumulate into a series of powerful unconscious lifelong beliefs about herself and templates for her expectations of others. So in the above example, you know, that I just mentioned, of mom responding over and over, when this happens repeatedly, I get upset, but mama's right there. You know, when the baby expresses distress, this suite of lessons would include things like, I am worthy of love. Others care for me. I can trust. My needs are attended to. Love feels good. Connection is safe. There is enough. All is pretty much right with the world. Now, when we aren't present in a fairly attuned way with our babies, it is usually not because of anything malicious or evil, but most likely because of our own early patterns, or perhaps because of postpartum depression or some other impinging factor that got in the way. It rarely has to do with bad intentions. So please hear me. There is no blame or shame here, just a lot of compassion. I myself had a very hard time being present when my first child was born. So when a baby or a toddler or a preschooler doesn't experience attuned presence from her parents or others in the way that nature intends and that the baby's expecting, a different set of internal working models is accumulated. That's the name that they gave in the research to those series of lessons, internal working models. It's a very different set of those is accumulated, and very often the exact opposite of the ones that I just ran down a minute ago. And by the way, keep an ear out for any of these that feel familiar, because so much of this, as I discussed in the teleseminar, has to do with running into our own childhood stuff. So here are some beliefs, some internal working models that we can pick up when we didn't get that kind of presence. I am not worthy of love. Others don't care for me. I can't trust the world. My needs don't count. It's my fault when things don't go right. Connection isn't safe. There isn't enough to get what I need. Everything's hard. So I call attachment is a pretty it's a pretty abstract notion, and even people who've been practicing attachment parenting may be hard pressed to define attachment. I like to call attachment lessons embedded in relationship, and it really is pretty accurate to call it that. And that is the equivalent of internal working models. Based on their experience of the world, and their first world is their relationship with you, your children develop internal working models of what love is, of what connection feels like, and what the world in general is like and how it works. So on your e-guide, I've given you the prompt to think about what kind of internal working models you think you might have gathered and are working with in your life, and also your children. As an example, I struggled a lot with presence when my son Ian was born, and I would say that I can see that in him. I can see that struggle. That's probably too strong a word. But I can see that it doesn't come completely fluently to him. You know, intimacy isn't quite the natural order of things. So back to these mother-baby attachment dances. So they're picking up all these lessons, but there's another more hardwired kind of lesson that is being learned. And this is really the kicker. This is amazing. This amazing, almost unfathomable process of the baby piggybacking on his parents' neural regulating structures to manage his own internal balance comes with this really staggering twist. As he's doing this, his social brain is wiring itself up to match his parents' social brain. As he's piggybacking on his parents' regulating functions, he's doing a copy and paste. Which, that's just wild. It is wild. When I do a PowerPoint presentation, I have a slide with little arrows coming from the mother's forehead down to the baby's, because that is really what's going on. The baby is downloading, and the godfather of this whole field, Alan Shore, who wrote a book entitled Affect Regulation and the Origin of the Self. That's how central our self-regulation is to who we are. In his book, he writes, the mother is downloading emotion programs into the baby's right hemisphere. So this brings us to the real thrust of how we foster our own OSC health. Because as parents, not only is it possible to foster further development of our own social brain's health, but doing that is perhaps the most important investment that we can make in our children's lifelong success. Remember that bumper sticker? I haven't seen it in a while. It's never too late to have a happy childhood. Whoever came up with that was really actually onto something. Because even though, we can't change history and we can't change what happened in our lives, we can change our inner orientation to it. We can change how we make sense of our stories. And it turns out that one of the most powerful ways to foster OSC health is to engage in self-reflection, exploring your early life and your inner life with an attitude of compassionate curiosity. Consciously working on making sense of your own early story can rewire your OSC circuitry toward greater health and greater resiliency. And this is the miraculous discovery of the decades of the brain that started in the 90s, that we're never finished. We are works in progress always. So the attachment research found you know, at a time when they couldn't understand it because they didn't have the brain scans to see this, that the most robust predictor of healthy, secure attachment in a child is the ability of that child's parent to tell what they call a coherent narrative about his or her life. And if you go back and you look at that list of things that are mediated by the OSC in our brain on page one of your e-guide, you'll see, or maybe it's page two, you'll see that autobiographical memory is one of them. And it turns out that the ability to tell a coherent narrative about your early story demonstrates a healthy OSC development. And that in turn is reflected in the research in children with secure attachment. So on the e-guide, I've asked you to think about your own early story and, you know, if it hangs together in what they call a coherent narrative, which just simply means that, you know, it isn't just disjointed, like jigsaw puzzle pieces that aren't assembled, that it kind of hangs together. When I was, you know, when I was two, we were living in such and such, and when I was three, we moved here, and when I was, you know, that kind of thing. But don't despair if you're like I was. My narrative was like fragments of a fever dream. The beautiful news is that you can encourage your OFC development by working on your narrative, which I think is so cool. It's like it works both ways. And this is what Dan Siegel's book, Parenting from the Inside Out, is great for. There's lots of exercises in there for working with your own narrative. I've included that on the resources on your e-guide. And what was I just going to say about? Oh, and there was also a whole form of therapy that sprang up called narrative therapy. So writing in a journal, speaking into a, you know, a voice recorder, creating art, writing poems or songs, dancing, these are all wonderful ways to encourage further development of your social brain when it's done, especially when it's done with the really intentional goal of becoming more fluent and friendly with your own early story. So more practices that bring more presence, such as meditation, yoga, contemplative prayer, and mindfulness practice, they are the best parenting investment because they cultivate self-mastery, which is my preferred term to self-discipline. But you'll find it in lots of research that your self-discipline is first and foremost what sets the tone for how big or small an issue discipline with your own child or children will be. Again, it's that question that I asked in the teleseminar. Do I have mastery of something as fundamental as the flow of my own thoughts and feelings? So on the on your e-guide, I've included a prompt about just starting to ask yourself about your own self-regulation hygiene. That's what I call it, hygiene. What are some ways that you regulate from the outside in rather than the inside out? And we all do it. This is, again, no shame, no blame, just really self-exploration. Okay, so let's look at some mantras and meditations and mindfulness techniques that can really turn everything around by cultivating your own self-mastery and fostering your OSC health, I would say. New research comes down almost weekly showing how this wide range of practices improves our health, including the fact that they actually change the structure and function of our social brain. And again, remember that little secret side benefit for parents. It allows you to answer yes to that essential question. Do I, as a parent, have mastery over something as fundamental as the movement of my own thoughts? Our children pick up on these things wordlessly. They pick up on what's going on in our inner life. The words kind of roll off, but what they pick up on is what's going on inside. So when you can answer yes to that, there is a respect that comes that is deep and that tends to not waver. And so it really makes discipline a far less complicated issue in a family. So as I talk about some of these practices that cultivate a greater capacity for presence and, again, are your best parenting investment because they do foster this level of mastery, just note down the ones, note any that resonate for you. So let's start with mantra. We're going to start small. Mantras are little things. But as one of my dear friends and what I would call her kind of a spiritual advisor, she has said to me, never underestimate the power of an idea to organize your life. And that's really what a mantra is. It's sort of an organizing idea. And yes, you can use mantras for meditation, but you can use them on their own too. And Lord knows, you know, parents are very, very busy. So here are a few that have served people well in my experience. The first one, all is and will be well. All is and will be well. There's the very well-used one, which, I don't know, this too shall pass. It may be helpful to you. It's helpful to many. And it refers both to the quote-unquote positive and quote-unquote negative moments, right? Remember that, you know, she'll only be three so briefly. And if you do have my book, I really recommend that you read the epilogue before you, you know, read the intro and the epilogue before anything else. Okay, next mantra. This one I love. Breathing in, I calm my body. Breathing out, I smile. Breathing in, I calm my body. Breathing out, I smile. And then a mantra I love, and we're going to talk much more about it in the third module, is simply, I choose growth. I choose growth. Okay, so on to meditation. Meditation is, of course, the granddaddy of all the presence practices, and it has emerged in the literature as one of the best things that you can do for all aspects of your health and well-being. And one of the central purposes of meditation is to give us the chance to practice in a concentrated form for those 15 or 20 or 30 minutes or maybe even 10, the level of presence that we then seek to carry with us into our daily activities. I love how Jon Kabat-Zinn once wrote that it's far better to meditate every day for 3 minutes than 20 minutes never. Meditation also opens up this space within which your own powers of intuition can take root and grow. And that's really ultimately what Parenting for Peace is about. It's about getting you connected up with your own intuition and feeling a confidence in that. Meditation over time becomes like a cosmic hotline to a level of knowing that is simply not available anywhere else. And just like physical exercises changes the way your body metabolism works for the rest of the day, meditation uplifts and unfolds your consciousness long after you get up off of the mat or the sofa or the chair or the bed, and it expands and it enriches your inner resources for whatever the day is going to bring. It is so worth getting up 15 minutes before the rest of the family to do it. So I'd love to see a show of hands at this point by pressing star 6. Raise your hand if you have now or have had in your life, let's say, a somewhat consistent meditation practice. I just want to get a sense of who out there might be a meditator already. I know that my meditation practice suffered quite a bit when I became a parent, but I had been meditating before. And finally, at some point, I was able to carve out some space to do it. Okay, cool. Wonderful. So there's one caveat, and I used to do a meditation in the course of this module, and I don't anymore, because it has become clear in some research that I've encountered that meditation can be contraindicated if you struggle with anxiety. And because I don't want to exacerbate anyone's anxiety if that is the case, I refrain from doing it on the live calls, but I certainly invite you to. And one very simple, very powerful meditation I learned from Deepak Chopra's daughter, Malika, who I did a presentation with, and this, of course, Deepak taught her and her brother. And it's simply the I Am meditation. You know, you just sit, get comfortable, spine straight. On the in-breath, you say I, say it in your head. On the out-breath, am. I am. I am. Okay, so now to really the superstar here, and certainly the one that's most friendly for parents to use, is mindfulness practice. And mindfulness is really just another word for presence. Mindfulness is a kind of meditation in action, bringing all of you to whatever it is you're doing or whomever you're with. I shared in the teleseminar about Jeffrey Schwartz, the UCLA psychiatrist, and his remarkable use of mindfulness to cure OCD. So mindfulness is the most transformative and also the most challenging when you can bring presence to those mundane activities, you know, that you do all the time, chopping celery, cleaning the toilet, shopping for groceries. So part of your homework, and I will be covering the homework later, is to choose one of your regular activities to practice this with. So rather than letting your mind wander while the rest of you does the activity, you devote your full, undivided attention to it. Now, if we perceive these chores and these tasks as an empty series of motions, it's hard to keep our attention on them. But when you can begin to unfold layers of dimension to it, it then becomes more engaging. And it helps to think of it as sort of weaving or establishing a relationship with that activity or that object or that substance. One of the first things that we do when we're starting a relationship is to express interest in the details of the other. So here's just two examples. The small act of eating a piece of fruit can take on a whole new dimension if we turn your attention to what is embodied, for example, in that apple. Think about the seasons of nurturance by rains and by sun and by the people who cared for the tree that it came from, and to the amazing fact that the flesh of that fruit is going to be transmuted into you in the coming hours and days. I mean, that's just wow. And then the other example, and this is a great one and very challenging actually, is showering. The very phenomenon of a shower is an amazing thing, deeply pleasurable. There's people in many parts of the world who would find a shower utterly miraculous. So, you know, try doing that with mindfulness. Instead of, you know, we use the shower for rehearsing for our day coming or replaying yesterday or, you know, detouring to any of the gazillion places that our minds tends, you know, to pull us when we shift into autopilot. So instead, try to keep all of you in the present as you soap up, as you shampoo, as you rinse, rinse and repeat. Just see how deeply you can engage in each of those delicious sensations And then when your mind does start to wander, just like in meditation, you don't punish it, you don't berate it, you just gently bring it back, just like you would a child. Arm around the shoulder, just gently bring it back. Now, when we can cultivate this greater capacity for presence, we also create a tendency for this greater level of presence. You know, that greater tendency for it to become our default mode. And that is awesome for your children, because your presence is ultimately the most basic nourishment for their most really robust and resilient development. And being present also deeply nurtures us in a very tangible brain way. And this has to do with the dangers of multitasking and why we don't want to model it for our kids. There was a fascinating study at Oxford University that found that when a volunteer subject performed a habitual task on autopilot, what happened was, and they had his brain all wired up, you know, to the lights, you know, to the, you know, imaging technology. What happened when he went on to autopilot with the task is all of those lights went out. It looked like an office building after closing time, they wrote in the study. So what happens is this kind of disengagement of brain centers can lead surprisingly rapidly to diminished brain tissue volume in those areas. And now what they know is that that diminished brain volume can contribute to depression, which, and it can take very little diminishment of brain volume, brain tissue volume, to contribute to depression. And depression is the exact opposite of what we cultivate with mindfulness. We tend to just find these wells of gratitude and delight. Now, the amazing opportunity that the Oxford study illuminated was this. After watching the subject's higher brain activity go pretty much dark as he worked on autopilot, the researchers asked him to once again bring his full attention to the task he was doing. It had to do with a numerical keypad sequence, right? They said, bring your mind back and do it as if you were doing it again when you were first figuring it out. And he did that, and his higher brain centers quickly reengaged, and all the lights came back on. I mean, this is amazing. This right here, this little nugget, this is an awesome thing. And so mindfulness is the opposite of multitasking. I've given you, in your resources section, there's some great little articles and tips for getting started with a mindfulness practice, or enriching one if you have one already, in the mindfulness primer at mindful.org. And Thich Nhat Hanh, who is the Buddhist monk and peace activist who wrote the original book, The Miracle of Mindfulness, he's got some of the articles there too. So it's a really great resource. So I've asked you to list some activities in which you tend to multitask. And, you know, if you're like most of us, like, everything. So, just, you know, a lot of this process, you guys, is about bringing awareness to what we have been doing a lot on autopilot. And let's face it, a lot of us actually parent on autopilot. So, you know, just by looking at starting to look at this stuff, you are really doing a beautiful thing, and you're just really kicking up your parenting a notch. And I just invite you to have patience with the process. So I want to talk briefly about the presence and empathy connection. The single most extraordinary form of nurturance, which is one of the seven principles of my book, is empathy. And empathy means not just being able to put yourself in the place of the other and sort of getting their experience, but also very important dimension of it that a lot of people leave out includes caring about the experience. A lot of people can do empathy and use it manipulative way. You know, a lot of those brilliant marketers and salespeople, oh, they have great empathy. They really get where you are, but they don't care about it. Empathy is really a mode of deeply seeing the other so that the other feels felt. This is a phrase that one of Dan Siegel's patients used once, and so it's now turned up in Dan's writing, and I love that. So that your child feels felt. I mean, I think we all know either that feeling or that longing to feel felt. And again, Gaber Mate, he writes in that book, Scattered, about attending, meaning being present to, as a basic active form of loving. And on your e-guide, I've included a link to the 5 languages of love test, and it's really kind of fun to take. And so it's more of a fun thing. You know, it's not, none of this is a requirement, but it's interesting to find out how important is full presence to you in order to feel loved. It's one of the 5 languages of love, quality time, which equals presence. So, you know, back in that go-to move at the beginning, when the mother, you know, says to her child, "Yeah, I saw you fell down. That must hurt." And he stops crying. It's because he's been heard. And this is a kind of nurturance, this kind of empathy, that just really fosters connection, again, not only between a parent and a child, but between a child and his or her own inner knowing. I'm not really going to go into discipline guidelines or techniques today. We're going to be getting into that a lot, of course. But here is an overarching helpful concept to keep in mind. And it did appear on a bullet on the page about the course, so I figured I had to cover it. And that has to do with presence and attention and attraction. And that has to do with what I call attention hygiene. Simply, whatever you put your attention on, you attract more of. When we're upset or angry or annoyed, we're choosing to be present to that which we don't want. When we get annoyed or angry with our children, the same thing happens. We're being present to everything we don't want rather than standing in that loving, authoritative center and focusing on what we do want and what we calmly expect from our child. So Becky Bailey wrote in a book that I really like, Easy to Love, Hard to Discipline. She writes, "Learning to focus your attention on the outcomes that you desire will bring you enormous power. It is probably the most important technique you can learn for living peacefully with children and with other adults and for finding joy in life." And we're going to be talking a lot more as the weeks go on about practical ways to do that, you know, how to calmly expect what you do want. So, just I want to change it up here for a second and talk about this paradox that comes up when we talk about presence. And it isn't talked about a lot. And it's where I depart from some quote-unquote experts because I like to differentiate between doses of full presence and 24/7 physical presence and undue preoccupation. Jean Leadloff, who some of you may know as the author of The Continuum Concept, she wrote this groundbreaking book where she went and she spent time with the Yacana people in South America. And what she found was there were no terrible twos or any of the other quote-unquote normal discipline issues. And she boiled it down to that the great majority of the caretaker's time is spent paying attention to something else and not the baby. Yes, the babies were, you know, carried around most of the day, but the moms were going about their daily business. And the babies just were sort of along for the ride. And then, you know, in between, they'd stop and sing a little song with the baby, and they would have their moments of presence. I'm not saying, believe me, I am not saying we go, you know, and take off our clothes and live like the Yacana at all. I have never been an advocate of that. But I think there's a lesson that we can learn from it. Rudolf Steiner teaches that children are to constellate around adults and not the other way around. And largely with a shift away from, you know, sort of the manual labor of the home, you know, before we had all these labor-saving devices and our lives became so technology-focused, children could sort of tag along as we did laundry, as we did, you know, and again, I'm not saying let's go back to the good old 50s, okay, because I am not romanticizing that. But there is something to be said for having good, hands-on engagement with the world kinds of activities that a child can tag along with you on. Because what has happened is we've become a culture of parents who are trained on the children and sort of constellating around them and figuring out how are we going to keep them engaged, how are we going to keep them entertained, how are we going to, rather than going about our lives and having the children be constellating around us. So, you know, this does raise a puzzling conundrum, this idea of the need for presence. And it requires distinctions that are in some ways very subtle, you know, with respect to presence. And it is this, it is a 21st century paradox for sure when we're all sitting with our screens. The need for a presence, you know, a parent's presence to a child without her unduly weighty preoccupation with the child. Now, we're going to pick this up again. I wanted to just float this as an idea for you to think about and just sort of start to give some thought to and reflection to. We're going to circle back around to it in Module 3 with Growth or Protection Detector. Okay, so to kind of head down the home stretch here, I want to give you some more real practical ways that you can, you know, bring more presence, bring more capacity for presence, bring more opportunities for presence into your life. So simplicity is one great way to do this. Simplicity is one of the seven principles in my book. And here is an all-purpose use anywhere presence trick, and that is to slow down. I have this little phrase, slow down, pleasure up. Allow twice as long as you think that it should take to do anything, whether it's a trip to the store, you know, to the farmer's market, a visit to the playground, the park, a stop at the library. You know, write this formula down and put it up on your refrigerator. Perceived time requirement times two equals sanity, joy, and peace. The biggest obstacle to presence, I shouldn't say the biggest, one big, because a big one is our own stuff that we've talked about earlier. But one big one in a practical sense is our adult agenda. It is the status quo in our culture, in every endeavor, to do more, be productive. This is one of the big shifts you make when you make presence a central value in your parenting and in your life. Because in today's sped up, must go faster, must do more world, you will find that many homes of even the youngest children echo with the chill of cool, expedient efficiency. We have become this hyper-practical, results-focused culture that is so often just too busy to slow down to child time, which is inherently more molasses-paced. You know, to kneel down to our child's level, to listen to her story, to put our arms around our boy and look at that bug he just caught, it just so often doesn't jibe with our lockstep schedule. And the child's deepest need really is to be seen and known. And so when we can simplify daily life, that it helps that to happen more. Another little catchphrase of mine is, when we overbook, we overlook. another kind of direct shortcut to presence is wonder, which is really a form of simplicity. I call it curious simplicity. So, you know, this curiosity, wonder is a great shortcut into presence, together with what my dear friend Joseph Chilton Pierce calls living in constant astonishment. So you can say, you know, today I'm going to see everything anew. I'm going to look at a tree as if I've never seen one. I'm going to open the closet as if I've never before seen a whole wall of clothes hanging for me to choose from. And it's really helpful to approach this by thinking about looking out at the world through your child's eyes. Everything is new and amazing through a child's eyes. That sense of, wow, water out of the tap, you know, or, whoa, text sent over phone lines through squeaky little noises, brings you right into the moment. And once again, I'm old-fashioned by referring to faxes. I mean, does anybody fax anymore? But I find faxes even more wondrous than sort of the invisible electronic transmission of things. So this idea of simplifying is really powerful to cultivate presence. So I'm just going to give you two realms in which to think about it, schedule and environment. For your schedule, just think about your plan of things to do in a given day and see if you can trim it by one third. I know that there were days when my kids were young when I just went, you know what, I'm taking this off the books. Oh, my gosh, the joy quotient just went up immediately, you know, just right away. And also the environment. When I coach parents in their homes, invariably I have them take away at least 50% of the toys from the space, at least, usually more. And books, too. Books, too. Very often there's just too many books. You know, everything has more meaning when there's fewer of them, especially for a child. Also sounds. Think about the sounds that are going on in your house and whether that can be simplified and just sort of soothed. This idea of wonder, when you can cultivate that sense of wonder, it fosters, again, this rich simplicity. It is a form of simplicity because then everything becomes something amazing. Wind through the trees is fairies dancing. A piece of wood becomes an alligator or a doll. A spoon becomes a great flag or a king's scepter. And then you don't need to constantly buy things. So presence invites us to do less, to buy less, and to just be more. And that is very countercultural. That is very revolutionary. And depending upon your own experience of babyhood, of childhood, and whether someone was able to just be with you, this might be an incomprehensible concept and maybe even a little bit terrifying. It was for me. But babies and children are our Zen masters, inviting us every day to our own renewal. And with it, to their most vibrant flourishing as peacemakers. So before I get to your homework, I like to finish with a go-to fail-safe move. And I realize I should have included space for this on your e-guide. I will next week. So when push comes to shove, you know, and everything's melting down, if you can focus on meeting your child's two primary needs, which I mentioned above, to be seen and known, to be seen and understood, your go-to move with the presence tool is to ask yourself, am I seeing her right now? Am I understanding him in this moment? And here's the thing. It's okay to not have the answers. Thich Nhat Hanh, again, the guy who really wrote the book on mindfulness practice, he writes, the vitality is in the question. And that is so true. And so I invite you to see the beginnings of this program as just opening up the vitality of so many questions. So your honing your tool homework includes three items. Choose some recurring, quote-unquote, mundane activity with which to practice mindfulness as we were talking about it. Second one, I did not include this on the e-guide, so you need to jot it in. I'd love you to choose one mantra or meditation to use at least once or twice in the next week. And I'm hoping that one of them resonated for you, so you wrote it down. If you don't, you can email and I'll send you a cheat sheet on those. And then the third piece is sometime this week, well, I wrote it out here, when you have 10 or 15 or 20 minutes to yourself, ha ha ha, I know, sit quietly and check in with yourself and see if you can connect with that inner baby, that inner child at some age, and see who needs the most attention. Who's the most up? In the teleseminar I talked about how when we have a dodgy moment with our child, we're dealing with more than just ourself and our child. We're dealing with ourself, our child, and ourself as a child. So I'm really inviting you to start a relationship now with that inner you. See which age the inner you is most wanting some attention, most wanting to be heard and to be seen and to be understood. And ask her some of these things. What did you need? What did you need then that you didn't get? How would you have liked it to have been instead? And then just really envision that revised scenario as richly as you can. It's very powerful. And then if you can, just continue to meet with her in this way. And maybe take notes on it. Keep a little journal. Whatever feels right to you. And you can use that go-to presence nugget with her, in those moments when things are up with your child. Include her in that question. Are you seeing her right now? Or you're talking to her. You're going to say, am I seeing you right now? Am I understanding you in this moment? So one age, choose one age to kind of cultivate a relationship, one mindfulness target activity, and one mantra or meditation. Okay, so are there any burning questions? If you have any questions about what we've gone over today, as opposed to sort of a more general question that we'll address next week, which is really designed for going, into what comes up for you when you start to think about this and put it into practice. But if there's anything that's confusing you, anything you need clarification on, go ahead and hit *6, and we'll. We'll get that cleared up for you so you can really take off into the week in the fullest way possible. I'm not seeing any hands, so either that says you've been very clear or you've put everyone to sleep. I hope not. So what I really like to do is to close out these sessions with the quote that I opened with, and just see if it lands differently for you in light of what we've covered. So, again, from the wonderful John O'Donohue, when all the saying is said and all the doing is done, everything comes down to the integrity of individual presence. So this concludes Module 1 of How to Parent for Peace, 5 Tools to Transform Stressed Out into Sane and Centered. I never require that my students purchase my book, but if this material speaks to you, I do highly recommend it, Parenting for Peace, Raising the Next Generation of Peacemakers. It's available at Amazon or any of your favorite independent booksellers. It has been wonderful being with you. So until we're together next, I wish you peace in your parenting heart and confidence in your parenting choices. Bye for now.